This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, very good afternoon to you. Today, the federal government's transition advocate for the phase-out of the live sheep export trade has announced a new leadership group to help guide him through that process. And we'll find out who the members are of this strategic steering group shortly here on the Country Hour. Also, after 8 years in the making, Broome's brand new floating port is being opened today. So we'll go and take a look at that. 12:06 here on the Country Hour on the ABC right across Western Australia. First up today, the Australian Energy Infrastructure Commissioner says WA is in a very good position to learn from the mistakes made in the eastern states and ensure the energy transition to wind and solar has benefits for the whole community. Tony Marr has been visiting Western Australia this week. Commissioner, what's your assessment of the energy transition in WA so far?
The assessment is that it's at a really interesting point. I understand that the WA government's about to release their transmission plan of sorts, you know, give me a bit of a blueprint of what the plan is for the ongoing transition to renewable energy. And the other interesting component is the community benefits scheme or guidelines, which in my view is critically important. So we're kind of at a really interesting stage is my assessment after being here just only for a few days, Belinda.
How does it compare to the process that's underway in the eastern states?
Similar. And I think there's, you know, what I've heard is hopefully there's some learnings of what not to do in terms of engaging the community and you know, making a better outcome and giving people an awareness of what is planned, how it will roll out, where and by who. So, I mean, that seems to be a positive, but I have still heard some large concerns from stakeholders like councils that really are eager to have their role recognised and the capacity of, you know, that those organisations support and so that they can be part, a true, genuine part of this transition.
And what are they looking for in particular?
Looking for recognition of their role, looking for, as I say, capacity and resources to actually allow them to not only provide good input into the processes, but to help them implement it. And I think importantly, Belinda, again, making sure that those communities and you know, the councils that are at the core of most communities, that they benefit, because the risk is, and again, this has happened in some of the eastern states, is the councils don't have a lot of say or a lot of involvement necessarily, but it's a lot of the responsibility and a lot of the compliance falls to them. The community is looking to them to, you know, be a responsible stakeholder. And at worst, they're steamrolled over and ignored and not given the right support and don't have the capacity to actually act in a role that they think they should.
And Tony, when you say community benefits, give us an example of what you're talking about where a project like this can have benefits for the wider community.
Well, I mean, it's recognition that the community is hosting this infrastructure and rewarding and compensating and, you know, making sure that there is the benefits are shared equitably. So in the eastern states, there's been lots of community grants and things, which are fine, but it really does need to move on to longer-lasting, legacy, genuine community benefits that people can see. They can see that they're there for the long term in a way that is parallel to this infrastructure. This infrastructure is going to be there for 50 or 100 years. So the benefits need to be long-term as well. It's no point just sort of having just community grants. They can work, but I think what the community is looking for, councils are looking for, is long-term regional benefits that are lasting and that are tangible.
So what's that like, putting in a swimming pool or a community centre, things like that?
Well, it can be. Yeah, they definitely can be. But things like, and I've said this in the past, you know, aged care, childcare, health care, these are really big dollar, big commitments that make big impacts on communities. So, sure, it can be, pool or netball courts and those sorts of things. But the key point is that the community and the councils have a real say in that. And there's, you know, an aggregated collective approach to making sure that the community is listened to when they say these are what benefits will, you know, make a difference, then that's listened to and that's committed to by not only the energy companies but the state government as well.
And because Western Australia is at relatively early stages of this transition, energy transition process compared to the eastern states, do we have a chance here to get this right?
You definitely do, is my, again, interim response or assessment, is that there is an opportunity to actually learn from what hasn't happened well enough in, you know, states like Victoria and New South Wales. WA does have an opportunity to learn from that. And the conversations I've had with Western Power and Powering WA, and they, it appears as if, you know, they've recognised that and, you know, just have to trust that will manifest itself in a better outcome over here.
This is The Country on the ABC, right across Western Australia. Tony Maher is here today. He is the Australian Energy Infrastructure Commissioner. Tony, what is your role in this process?
Well, it's a national role, Belinda, that is appointed by the federal government, independent of government and independent of industry. And the task is a couple of fold. I take complaints from constituents, from councils, from the community about what they see as poor behaviour. I mean, this is a national transition that is having a huge impact on communities. So I talk with, you know, affected landholders that think there is problems and concerns with how the transition's being rolling out, and then I raise them and try and get them resolved with energy companies and or state governments. But I also try and push best practice. The previous commissioner did a community engagement review which identified pretty appalling behaviour and practices from the energy company. So my task is to hold them to account and improve their operations and behaviours and make sure that there's a better outcome for the community as part of this energy transition.
But ultimately, is your role to clear obstacles to help the government reach its energy transition goals?
No, I wouldn't classify it like that. I'd classify it in making sure that this transition is ultimately a benefit to the community. And, you know, there's some real problems with how that's rolling out. The community isn't sharing in the benefits in an equitable way. They feel like they're sort of being steamrolled and you know, dismissed, concerns being dismissed. So my role is to make sure that the concerns and challenges are heard and we get a better outcome for the community.
How do you ensure that you get the balance right between this transition process but also ensuring that we're addressing sort of food security issues or protecting prime agricultural land or even scenic vistas?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, my role being independent, I can actually point out to government and try and influence government to make sure that they are recognising those factors and with the companies as well. I mean, they are cognizant of the need to do that. It's not translating necessarily into actions, though. So, you know, having conversations and pointing out that the community does need to be brought along. We do need to look after our agricultural land and we do need to have the right infrastructure in the right place. I mean, that's the message, that's the advocacy that I've been doing and will continue to do. This transition has been happening for a couple of decades. It will continue to happen. My job is to make sure that it is done right and we get a good outcome from this transition.
And I guess the responsibility ultimately for this transition is happening in these rural and regional parts of Australia, in these communities. So while there might be huge support within the metropolitan areas, the community, for this transition process, it's not happening in their backyard, though, is it? It's happening where, you know, out of mind, out of sight. Is there a little hypocrisy in that, do you think?
Well, I think, it's a reality that this infrastructure is going in rural and regional communities. But again, that that's the challenge, to make sure that there is an equitable arrangement, that the rural and regional communities are not being burdened and carrying all of the weight. They need to have the benefit, and they need to actually be recognised for the role that they are playing. And that's where, you know, these community benefit schemes that the WA government's consulted on is really important. But also, as I say, the right planning, so we get the right infrastructure in the right spot, and we don't compromise agricultural land, and we don't put things in place that are going to disrupt communities to the point where there's a negative outcome. I'm firmly of the view that it can happen, and it can happen in a way that is equitable and a net benefit. But it's going to take everyone to understand and commit and recognise that it needs to be done right.
Tony, great to have you here on the Country. I appreciate your time.
Terrific. Thanks for having me, Belinda.
That's the Australian Energy Infrastructure Commissioner, Tony Marr, who's been in WA this week. And he thinks WA is in a good position to learn from the mistakes made in the eastern states and ensure the energy transition to wind and solar has benefits for the whole community. So if that is happening in your community, what's on the wish list? Because Tony thinks if one of these big projects gets the tick at your place, then there needs to be benefits for that whole community, not just those landowners involved in the deal. So what would be on your wish list? Aged care, childcare, healthcare were some of the things Tony mentioned. What do you think? What's on the list? Let me know. 0448 922 604. Text through and have your say. 16 past 12.
The Country Hour.
We exported the largest volume of lobster.
Celebrating 80 years.
Isn't that quite exciting?
The Country Hour.
Get up.
Part of your community.
Fight the bullet.
And your life.
Keep moving.
For 80 years on ABC Radio.
This just in from Sebastian, who says that I've tried talking to a wind farm company and have been blocked from speaking to them via phone. They're not interested in our concerns. Thank you for that, Sebastian. 0448 922 604. That's the text to be part of the conversation. The federal government's transition advocate for the phase out of the live sheep export trade has announced a new leadership group to help guide the process. Dr. Chris Rodwell, who's overseeing the 2028 phase out, has named three leaders from the sheep and wool industry to form the strategic steering group. That group is going to be led by Erin Gorter, Bindi Murray, and Ashley Herbert. Chris Rodwell says he needed strong industry insight to develop a practical action plan for the transition.
I guess when I first started in the role, I asked a lot of people very early in the piece, what does good look like for the sector, both in terms of the transition and beyond the transition? And I got lots of mixed responses, as you can appreciate. And so it was very clear through those questions and also through the co-design process as well, that there needed to be, I guess, a bit of a light on the hill, on a near-term hill, not one in the far distance, that kind of painted a bit of a picture for what good could look like, but more importantly, helped provide confidence, helped guide choices, and helped guide investment. There very quickly was that need to develop, I'm going to call that a plan or an action plan, and then in the process of doing that, to be able to identify any areas as well as the broader transition package that needs some extra areas of attention. And I needed some clever people with the right experience, skills, and the right intent to help me do that. So that's the birthing of that group.
So the group is called the Strategic Steering Group. Can you just describe to me, Chris, what the role of this group is going to be going forward?
Well, it's primarily that. So it's to be looking at where to for the sector, how do we capture the most value for the sector going through, and helping to steer the best possible result for WA through that process. The plan will be one of the main products out of that. And very quickly, what we're wanting to do is get a really evidence-based understanding of where the sector is currently sitting at. Obviously, things have changed quite a bit and the market's shifted and market signals have shifted quite a bit since the start of the year. So we really want to get a good handle on numbers, impact, and then that gives us sort of a starting point to work from, and then where to from there.
So who have you chosen to be on it and why?
When I first started in the role, obviously I met lots of different people, and I was really impressed with the three members that I've got on the group, Aaron Gorter, Ashley Herbert and Bindi Murray. I think the main thing is, as your listeners can probably appreciate, speed is incredibly important here. We've sort of got a bit of a ticking clock. We've got large investment streams being rolled out, big grant programs. So we needed to form a relatively small group, a trusted group, and work together really quickly. So small, the right people in the right room for the right reasons. And I reckon all three of those people meet that, I guess, criteria. Highly respected, highly experienced, and I think we'll cover all of those aspects. We will have, of course, other people and other, I guess, experience that we'll need to bring into the group at various different points, because there will be things that other people will have the majority of expertise in. So it's not an exclusive group. That's the core of it. And obviously it's charged with sort of motoring quite quickly to help steer what we need to, given all the moving pieces.
Dr. Chris Rodwell, the transition advocate for the live sheep export phase-out, speaking to Kate Forrester. As he mentioned, the group is made up of three industry members. So there's Aaron Gorter, a rural industry consultant. Ashley Herbert is an agribusiness consultant. And Bindi Murray, a sheep and wool producer. The group will serve an initial term of 12 months with an option to extend the term when that's up. And you can find out more information about this new strategic steering group online if you'd like to. Just search strategic steering group and you should find that information on the Department of Agriculture's website. 21 past 12. Winemakers in the state's southwest are calling for a pause on wine bottles being included in the Containers for Change scheme. Earlier this week, the state government announced from the 1st of July next year, you will get 10 cents back when you return glass, wine and spirit bottles. The reward for each returned bottle comes from the organisation that makes the beverage. Margaret River Wine Association's Amanda Whiteland says the costs will be a large impost on small businesses.
The Margaret River Wine Association calls for a pause on the wine bottles in the CDS expansion. We support smarter recycling, but expanding bottle deposit schemes to wine without proper evidence or consultation, that risks unfair costs on small producers, particularly in the Margaret River region, where 95% of our producers are small family-owned businesses without real evidence-based environmental gains.
What kind of costs are we talking about?
Oh, look, at a minimum, there's probably a direct cost of 20 cents a bottle. But when you add in all the administration costs of executing the scheme as it's currently unique in every state, there's no harmonisation. It could be up to a dollar a bottle. So that could be up, you know, we sell over 25 million bottles of Margaret River wine domestically. We're only 2% of Australia's crush, so we're a small region, but, you know, that could be up to, say, $25 million. It could cost industry a year, every year.
Wow. So what are the wine producers having to pay for in this implementing this scheme?
Yeah, you've got to declare how many bottles you've sold in every state and then pay per bottle, regardless of if the bottles ever return to a CDS scheme or not. So, there's a large impost on the producers. It's not shared down the supply chain. It falls directly on the wine producer. And then, you know, a lot of small businesses are unable to pass those costs on, particularly in a highly consolidated retail market that we have here in Australia. So when CDS came into water bottles and things, you know, we saw that it got passed on and the cost of buying water increased. We're concerned that it's going to be hard to pass those costs on. You know, you get wet tax and you get your GST and all those costs continue to add on. So, yeah, it could cost the consumer a lot more as well.
So when you say a pause, what would that look like?
Yeah, a pause would give consultation to industry, absolutely. We would, if a scheme was to be implemented, we would love to see a harmonised scheme across the country. Currently, you know, it's not, so that puts a huge administration burden back on producers.
Amanda Whiteland, she's the Chief Executive Officer for the Margaret River Wine Association. She was speaking to Jackie Lynch in reaction to the announcement that from the 1st of July next year, you are going to get at least 10 cents back when you return glass wine and spirit bottles, wine and water casks, as well as containers for concentrated fruit and vegetable juices, flavoured milk and cordial. Pretty much everything except plain milk and registered health tonic containers. State Environment Minister Matthew Swinburne says this was an election commitment and it will bring WA more in line with other states to further reduce landfill and increase recycling. He says the wine and spirit sector has been exempt from this shared responsibility for 5 years. The Department of Water and Environmental Regulation has consulted with key stakeholders, including the wine and spirit industries, and will ensure there are transition periods for labels to be changed so producers are not out of pocket. Minister Swinburne also says small producers will have the option to report sales volumes and pay scheme costs less often than bigger suppliers, reducing the administrative burden. On the text, in agreement with the minister, the wine industry had a huge pause. They should have been included right from the start. The text 0448 922 604. 26 past 12. We'll get an update from the newsroom for you shortly. First, after 8 years in the making, Broome's brand new floating port is being opened today. It's called the Kimberley Marine Support Base, or the KMSB. Managing Director Andrew Natter believes it will benefit mining, agriculture and tourism in the north.
It is definitely going to reduce costs with travel distances, but also getting to market too. You know, there's a lot of producers out there that have been trying to get their product, but, you know, been inhibited by the distance they need to travel to get their product out. And so now it really opens up the door, and we're seeing that every day with different people and parties and industries coming to us going, can we do this out of this location? And there's no question, like, the way that we design our infrastructure is for it to be non-biased. And the reality is, to make something last, you've got to build it, you know, to be robust. You know, this is the fun part of my job, like going through the engineering. It is exciting, and every time I walk out there, you know, I'm impressed by the structure. What it does enable industry now to progress, and that's, you know, what I love about ports. And you think about Western Australia, where the southern ports, where you get Albany and you get Bunbury and then you get Fremantle and you get Geraldton, each where you get a well-functioning port, I always say you get a well-functioning community. And I think what we've done with the KMSB is to really just add to the Kimberley Port Authority and allow now those that do want to take the opportunity, could be compressed hay bales, you know, whatever it might be. The reality is now that there is capacity and the ability to do what they want to do.
So do you think the KMSB offers opportunities for small producers as well as large corporate operators, or is it mainly set up for those
Absolutely.
Large corporate operators?
No, not at all. Not at all. Our model is like co-op. So, sure, there's going to be some large operators, but we'll service predominantly, you know, smaller operators as well. So, yes, we will service a certain amount of that larger, but it's not going to be a mainstay. And the reality is now we can operate through the whole tidal window. That's not going to affect us at all. So there's plenty of capacity to be able to service everyone.
For anyone who hasn't seen the facility, can you explain what it looks like? I know it features a floating wharf.
Yeah, so if you go into the existing Port Authority and you drive down the road, what we have is, you know, I call it the causeway. And so the causeway actually, it lands on the road near the entrance to the existing wharf. And the causeway is wider than the Northwest Highway, and it's very structural and very, very strong. It is also bi-directional, so no different than driving down, like I say, the Northwest Highway. There's plenty of room for trucks to go past each other in opposite directions. So that runs out nearly 300 metres to the floating asset. And the floating asset is almost a hectare in size, and basically it's a steel structure that goes up and down with the tide and is very, very stable. Like I said, everything's really robust and structural. So basically we have our berth face, and that really allows for vessels anywhere up to 300 metres to come alongside. So you're thinking about those, whether it's those cruise ships or the general cargo ships, you know, with containers on them, are able to tie up. And we have what we call fixed mooring dolphins that allow those vessels to tie alongside and hold them in place. And, you know, we have a crane, which is a harbour crane, and it's a mobile harbour crane. So you can drive up and down that whole face of that berth to be able to unload vessels.
Managing Director of the Kimberley Marine Support Base, Andrew Natter, speaking to Jess Baker. And while today marks the formal opening of the facility, operations will officially begin on Monday. 12:30 here on the Country Hour. Jonathan Hopper in the studio with the news headlines.
Good afternoon, Belinda. A man who is driving a car which hit a teenager in Perth after a car club meet has indicated he will plead guilty to a charge of dangerous driving. Chun Lai Yuen was driving a car on Camfield Drive in Burswood in July when the vehicle struck a 17-year-old girl. Yuen was charged with dangerous driving, causing grievous bodily harm. US authorities have released more images and a video of the person suspected of killing right-wing activist Charlie Kirk. The footage shows the person of interest walking across and jumping down from a roof of a building at the Utah University. The FBI says the assailant then walked into a wooded area, and they're appealing for anyone with information to come forward. And Ange Postecoglou admits he knew he'd be sacked prior to leading Tottenham to last season's Europa League title. The 60-year-old helped end Spurs' trophy drought, but a 17th-placed finish in the Premier League saw Postecoglou ousted. He faces a new test after being appointed as manager of Nottingham Forest. Thanks, Belinda.
Thanks so much for the update. Appreciate that. 29-1.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio, WA.
Great to have you along, and a few of you keen to jump in on the conversation we had a little earlier with the Australian Energy Infrastructure Commissioner, Tony Marr, visiting WA this week, and just saying that WA is in a pretty good position to learn from the mistakes that have been made in the eastern states and to ensure that the energy transition to wind and solar has benefits for the whole community. And he says, you know, when a big project like this is going to go ahead in your town, then you really need to lay your cards on the table for what your community needs. And he mentioned things like aged care, health care, childcare, things like that. And I was curious to know what you would like to see in your community if one of these projects get the tick. This from Kim in Wamaran, is it, in the Northern Ag Zone? The local governments need assistance to fund ongoing medical services costs to provide a GP for the community. Aged care, housing is also much needed. We need a commissioner like Tony Marr for plantation forestry, where we're seeing the same issues and concerns for agriculture and local government. Thank you, Richard. This from Jeff. Re the renewable projects. Permanent population is what we want and need. Money investment will come once the population is here. And Tom says population depleted farmlands in the Great Southern will have multiple new imposts. Fires through rocky terrains 24/7, water insufficiency, volunteer fire brigade manpower diminished numbers, gravel already in short supply to build heavy crane roads through soft paddocks, road upgrades at Shire's costs. There are multiple impediments and imposts not being discussed. Text through, be part of the conversation, 0448 922 604. Shortly, we'll catch up with what's going on at the firearms inquiry that is taking place. It started earlier in the week, and a couple of interesting groups putting their perspective to that inquiry today. We'll also get a wrap on the wool market, which is up again this week. Danny Burkett along shortly to go through those details. First to the Bureau of Meteorology, Bob Tarr with you today. Hi, Bob. Let's take a look around the Southwest Land Division.
Yeah, so pretty warm temperatures through much of the region. We have very broad northeast to northerly winds coming down ahead of a cold front. So most places aside from the far southwest corner already into the 20s right now, and around parts of the lower west and the Midwest already above 25. So pretty warm temperatures for this time of year across the region. Plenty of sunshine aside from a little bit of high cloud passing through. And then that cold front will approach the southwest corner during tomorrow. There'll be a few showers developing out ahead of it. And then the actual front reaches the southwest corner later in the morning and then continues towards the north through areas like Harvey and Yarloop, and then reaches the Perth area around mid to late afternoon, and then weakens as it moves inland. So all up tomorrow, we're looking at some falls through the southwest and up into the Harvey area, where some of the higher falls could reach maybe 10 to 20 mils through that area, again, mostly with the cold front, and then lighter falls extending further north with the prefrontal showers and into the some of the wheat belt as well. Generally pretty light falls from that. And then that front will basically weaken as it moves inland on a Saturday night, Sunday morning, followed by another significantly stronger front reaching the west coast during the day on Sunday. And potentially we're going to have a severe weather warning for that front for possible damaging winds in an area from around Perth out through Esperance. Rainfall is fairly similar to what we're expecting on the previous day, Saturday. So through the lower west, especially up into the hills, and then into the southwest, we could see falls anywhere from about 10 to maybe at the high end 25 mils in the scarp from that feature, and then dropping off to maybe about 2 to 10 mils through far western parts of the wheat belt and the Great Southern. And as you go into sort of the central part of the wheat belt and the Midwest, probably only going to see about 1 to 5 mils from that front. And then as that front moves away during Monday, we still see some showers over the south coast and maybe up to about 5 to 10 mils around the immediate coast from that, but otherwise just a few residual showers over the lower west coast and adjacent inland parts of the south coast, with some drier weather setting in with a ridge. Nothing really significant on Tuesday, mostly just a ridge pattern with maybe very light coastal showers. But then the next cold front comes through on Wednesday. We'll have some decent winds in the southwest corner, but most of the rain with that one, again, stays over the southwest corner with maybe 5 to 15 mils for some of those locations. And again, just a few mils at best in the gauge through much of the wheat belt and eastern parts of the Great Southern. Then again, some residual showers for Thursday behind that. And it looks like once we get beyond that front that comes in the middle of the week, then we're probably looking at a more extended period of dry weather for the Southwest Land Division.
And what can we see for northern and eastern parts, Bob?
Sure. So in the north, we've had just a couple of thunderstorms hanging on around the Warman area, sort of between Halls Creek and Kununurra this morning, but those are on their way out. We have a ridge of high pressure extending into the area, and it's pushing progressively drier air in through the Kimberley. So some pretty fresh and gusty winds through the region today. And then tomorrow, those winds will be a little bit lighter through the Kimberley and the adjacent North Interior and East Pilbara. And then basically, that ridge pretty much breaks down, so less wind over northern parts for Sunday and Monday, although we will have a new ridge extending into the western and southern parts of the Pilbara by Monday, so a little bit more of a fresher southerly through those areas. Really not expecting all that much in the rain gauge through northern eastern parts. Could see a few showers from the Gascoyne into the Goldfields during Sunday, but again, maybe just 1 to 3 mils at best from that, and then the next front probably doesn't really push any rain in through those areas. So all in all, looking like a fairly dry week across the northern eastern part of the state.
Bob, thank you for going through those details. 22 to 1, there is no rain across Western Australia in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. But Richard Hudson is in the studio now because there has been a major decision on Woodside's Northwest Shelf gas project.
Yeah, it's just received final approval from the federal government, extending its potential operating life to 2070. So Environment Minister Murray Watt has placed 48 additional conditions on the project, aimed at protecting nearby ancient Indigenous rock art. So these include reducing certain gas emissions by 2030 and reaching net zero emissions by 2050. The announcement comes almost 4 months after the minister provided Woodside 10 days to respond to his provisional approval for the extension. And as part of a separate federal court action brought by a traditional custodian, the minister also made a partial declaration to protect a significant heritage site involving the ancient Murujuga rock art, bringing additional legal protections to parts of that area, but not preventing industry from operating. But there is more to come on that pretty big story anyway.
Yeah, just repeating, Woodside's North West Shelf Gas Project has received final approval from the federal government, extending its potential operating life to 2070. 21 to 1 here on the Country Hour. And this morning, a number of organisations representing Indigenous people expressed their frustrations with the Western Australia's new firearms regulations. Now, Richard, you've been following proceedings this morning. What did you hear?
Yeah, so this is all part of the ongoing Firearms Act inquiry being held in State Parliament. And some of the people who spoke this morning represented native title holding organisations, which are also known as PBCs, which stands for Prescribed Bodies Corporate. I mention that because PBCs gets mentioned throughout this audio. Now, they talked about how hard and time-consuming it'll be for Indigenous people to gain or renew firearm licences under WA's new stricter gun regulations. And they mentioned how their PBC organisations are now having to deal with a lot of time-consuming bureaucracy. This is particularly relevant to those in station country where Indigenous people liaise with leaseholders to go hunting. And as you've heard on the Country Hour before, often leaseholders are the ones assisting others with the onerous red tape associated with licences and the now infamous portal. The first voice you'll hear from this morning's inquiry proceedings is Colin McKellar from the Yamaji Marapa Aboriginal Corporation.
Firearms licences will need to be renewed, and there'll be some work to be done to confirm that. There will be, you know, new people buying a gun for the first time, wanting to hunt for the first time, and that'll be, so there will be some ongoing process for that. One of the matters that can be quite burdensome is often people will hunt on country with friends and relatives who are not native title holders. So they're not, you know, your spouse might not be a native title holder, your cousin might come in from out of town to go on a camping trip. And the way the firearms system is set up, there's an expectation of this temporary permissions. And as it's under a temporary permission, they'll need to request the PBC or RNTBC to give a temporary permission, and that has to be done by one of the authorised people. And so the PBC, the RNTBC, will have to have some, you know, one of these authorised persons available essentially at any time to be contacted to say, okay, my cousin's coming this weekend, we're going out hunting, can you give us permission to be on country and hunt for 2 weeks? That's an ongoing request. I mean, you can have policies, again, about developing policies, but how this is done, who can request it. Again, the person who's receiving that request has to have a policy about when the RNTBC does give these temporary permissions. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, it won't be a carte blanche, I presume, of like, it needs to be requested by an appropriate person, needs to be, you know, deemed relevant. But that's an ongoing issue that's quite burdensome.
Yep, thank you.
Yeah, we'd always go to other people's country as well, travel through country, always welcome to hunt there. But now under these rules, we're only there to hunt our tribal country. Is there provision for us to be able to speak to the neighbouring PBC to get permission?
It's a temporary permission, though.
Yes, you can get temporary permissions.
And also, like, some of us, obviously, all of us, Scottish, Irish, Italian, whatever, you come from two different walks of life, your mother's grandmother. So, yeah, two or three different tribes claim you, you know, going from here to Broome or whatever, or Darwin. So, you know, you can get the first part out of the way, both sides, your mother's side, your father's, two different tribes, so that should cover that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then when you're up on country. Because it's a good thing in one way, from a PBC point of view, and the traditional owners, but if your traditional country is only 50 mile wide, there's only a certain amount of people can access at one given time, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But definitely, yeah, if it's accessible for both sides, probably run through the same porthole, two access forms put in, you know? Put one in, get that okayed, then you put in for the other side of your family and get that done. But we have a lot of people that don't want to be on the PBCs. They're Indigenous people, but they want to still run their business and have access to do whatever they need to do with a firearm.
Yeah.
And this might limit them if we don't look at it properly from all angles.
I think the point Uncle's trying to make and is that not everybody is a member of an Aboriginal corporation.
Yeah, yeah, no, I'm pretty
and,
sure that.
And now that seems to be the only place that you're going to get authority.
Yeah.
I can speak personally. It took 2 years for me to get my own membership to the Ballardong Aboriginal Corporation. Yeah. So if I did it a long time ago, but if it was now pressing because my firearms was expired, well, I've just handed in. And not only that, lose my business and everything else. So it takes even longer to get a membership process through a corporation. And like Uncle said, not everybody wants to be and not everybody needs to be. They might have disagreements with the corporation. They don't agree with the management. Why should they have to be a member just to be able to get customary activities?
Sure. So how could we how could we resolve that?
Previously, DBCA used to issue customary activities permits, and now they're not being accepted. And it was very easy to call the DBCA office and get a traditional hunting approval. It would be emailed out within the day, and that would be sufficient to obtain a firearm or as a genuine need. Now WAPOL are not accepting them.
Okay.
They're only accepting approvals through the corporations.
Okay. Do you have anything to add on?
I think to reinforce that, it'd be like to look at the Law Reform Commission WA recommendations. They provided a specific genuine the reason for the hunting licence. It was a traditional hunting licence. So there were considerations back in that review in the final report that actually had, Aboriginal and traditional owners could actually tick that as their reason for their firearms licences. So then it reinforces what's already provided for in other schemes, but it's then, Department of Biodiversity and Conservation, they can still have those licences, but then it's reinforcing the fact that we're entitled to have, be able to practice our traditional customs.
Yeah. Can I ask a question? I acknowledge up front is ignorant, but it's curious. Can you like explain to me the right to hunt, like what that actually means in practice, culturally, on the ground, and in law?
Yeah, Mark. You can have the mic.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Culturally and traditionally, now I'm 67 years of age. As a child growing up, every weekend, our father would go out on country early in the morning to get 2 or 3 kangaroos. He had, several guns. He had license to hold those guns. But this happened, a good 50-odd years ago. So every weekend we had to rely on traditional food because that was part of our diet. We suffer now with a lot of chronic illnesses, diabetes, heart condition, you name it, chronic illnesses. So the traditional food is part of our medicine. And so when we go out on country and hunting, that's what we did traditionally.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing it's the same with you, brother?
Yes.
Yep. So that's what I just wanted to state.
No, thank you. And it's a curious question, albeit an ignorant one.
Yeah, so and it's also, for our younger generation, when we take them out on country.
Yep.
Obviously, we take them from very young and teach them how to prepare the meat, hunt the meat, what do you do to hunt the animal, all these things, Because these days you get kangaroo shooters and everyone else there out there, people pull up with a car and the kangaroos are gone because they're going to get shot. So you got to teach them how to track, hunt, do all the things that you had to do, how to catch up to that animal, quietly catch it, all that, be able to shoot it or whatever.
Peter Windy, representing the Yemmajee Marapa Aboriginal Corporation. You also heard from Colin McKellar from the same corporation and representing Jildba Land Management was Kerri-Anne Winmar and Aaron Williams, and you also heard Angela Crombie from Aboriginal Legal Service of WA. And that last question came from the committee chair, Dr. Katrina Stratton, MLC. And this is part of the ongoing Firearms Act inquiry that's being held in State Parliament's Legislative Council. It started on Wednesday and it will end on September the 22nd. 11 minutes to one.
The Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
The new owner of the historic Yilgarn mining operation near Southern Cross expects its first trainload of iron ore to arrive at the Esperance port before the end of this year. About 1,000 workers were affected when the operation was placed into care and maintenance last year by previous owner Mineral Resources. The project, which has been in operation for nearly 80 years, was sold in June to privately owned company Yilgarn Iron for an undisclosed sum. Yilgarn Iron's David Paul and Peter McBain say they hope the new streamlined approach to mining the Koolyanobbing project will ensure its longevity.
It has only been a couple of short weeks. We're really well advanced. We've got a team on site that is ready to go. We've taken over the management of the accommodation facility from MinRes. We've got the responsible people, the statutory positions now in our hands on site. We hope to be hauling material from stockpiles around the site late this month. And we'll start processing again in October with a view to training ore in November.
You mentioned training ore, Peter. Does that mean you are going to continue to utilise the Esperance port? Because we know that when Mineral Resources divested, they also sold off their rolling stock and locos as well. So how's that process gone?
They certainly did. So we've engaged with Aurizon as our rail provider. They're in the process of sourcing our locos and wagons to service our needs. So, no, definitely going through Esperance Port. And also in relation to haulage and the mining fleets that we're engaging with, as part of the transaction with MinRes, we acquired full haulage fleets and mining fleets to execute our plan. So we're well equipped to progress.
One of the things, Tara, that that lower level of production allows us to do is focus on product quality. So we're not scratching for extra tons and then compromising potentially the quality of the product.
I was going to ask how you were going to do things differently. Is that essentially what it comes down to, this being your focus?
Yeah, I think it is. And also slowing down what's there. So, well, Yilgarn region is blessed with quite a number of iron ore deposits. They're relatively small. It takes care and attention. It also takes pretty much the same amount of work for a small deposit as a large deposit in terms of permitting and the approval processes. So it's about really focusing on getting that and getting ahead of the game so that you have a good, I guess we call it a runway of assets to develop it in the future. So that's really the approach we're going to take. The infrastructure and processing infrastructure we have is first class. So it's rebuilding the resource base to support it.
And we know that the royalty relief that MinRes were receiving for several years, is that process has finished. You have, however, had a nice little rise in iron ore prices, even in the last couple of days. Are you confident that you're entering, the market at a time where things are looking up?
Yeah, we certainly do have a view about the iron ore market, and it's to be relatively stable. I must say it's been a positive surprise the last month or so of the price action you've seen there. We're really planning for a more moderate price environment going forward. Obviously, higher prices are always welcome, but we probably see it being lower and stable for a longer period of time. So there are headwinds in the iron ore market, as you know. There's also headwinds on the supply side as well. So the pluses and the minuses will come through over time, but we're pretty confident. We've got a strategy and a suite of assets which will be able to ride the market both up and down.
Yilgarn Iron Investments Executive Director David Paul and the Managing Director, Peter McBain, speaking to Tara de Landgraft, and they've started a recruitment push and are keen to get locals involved either as employees or service providers. And once up and running, they're estimating they'll have about 400 to 450 direct employees. 6 minutes to one.
A tiny robotics company having a very big go.
I guess I'm betting on that we have the right team of people with the right approach to get it right.
That's Landline Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
Well, the wool market is on a real roll at the moment. The Eastern Market Indicator is up 28 cents to finish the week on 1,319 cents a kilogram clean. And here in the West, the Western Market Indicator is up 40 cents this week, closing at 1,464 cents a kilo clean. Danny Burkett, another good week to be selling wool.
Absolutely, and if I quote the AWEX report for the week, it says on a daily basis this rally has now run for 14 straight sessions, the longest stretch since 2011. That played out through all three centres, in particular Fremantle. We only had a one-day sale, which was held on Tuesday. We look at 17 microns, they closed roughly 50 clean dearer for the week at 18.15. 18 microns up 55 for the week, closing at 17.15. 19's up 50, 16.20 on the close. 20 microns up 55, 15.70 on the close. 21s, they've held above that magical resistance level of 1,500. They closed 30 up at 15.30. That 1,500 cent level is a significant level in the industry for 21 microns. If we look back roughly 30 years, we've only really broken through that, and that was through that huge rally in 2018, 2019. So if we can hold above 1,500 cents claim for a 21, it is a great indicator for the market. Pieces and Valleys also followed the combing market up 40 to 60 for the week. And if we look at 19 microns, they only separate pieces and fleece by $1.10. That is still fairly tight, which is a great, another good indication for the market. Locks, stains and cuttings all up 60 cents clean for the week. So a positive market across the board in all three centres. If we look at this in a ranking of percentiles for the last 5 years, this is based on the eastern states, but will reflect very closely to the west. 17 micron roughly sits at the halfway mark. 19 micron sits at the 70th decile. 21s, and I'd suggest 20s very close to it, at the 100% decile, so the highest price we've seen in 5 years. So very positive market driven by three factors in the wool market: supply, supply and supply.
All right, who was buying this week, Danny?
We saw Tech will come in and take a huge quantity this week of Merino fleece wool. If we just look simply at that, they've been in the market, but not as strong as they tend to be. So they took 20.5% of the Merino combing market fleece wool through the three centres. That was 3,529 bars, which is a significant quantity given the limited amount of wool on the market. PJ Morris, a West Australian-based business, 14.5%. Endeavour Wool Exports, 13.5%, Mellowa at 10.5%, and the big absentee in those top four is TNU. They generally are roughly one, first, second or third, but they were not in the top four, which again points to a very strong wool market. If they're out and we're getting driven this hard, that's a great sign for the market.
So let's have a look at next week then, Danny. If supply or the lack of supply is really driving this, how many bales on offer next week and what are your expectations?
We are just shy of 31,000 bales again next week. It's a one-day sale again in Fremantle. Just given that roughly one quarter to one third of what's being offered in Melbourne is still crossbred type, so there's limited amounts of Merino wool hitting the market. If we look back at the EMI, the Eastern Market Indicator in US terms, it jumped 30 cents last week. That's a significant lift for the Chinese purchasing our wool. But just says to me that quantity is the driver of the moment. We have the Nanjing Wool Conference that will be held in 2 weeks' time. I would suggest, and don't quote me, but I would suggest that maybe exporters are looking to get some stock up their sleeve when they head up there into China. They have something to sell. But that's still a fortnight away, so it bodes very, very well as we head into next week.
Danny, thank you for going through the wool market details for this week. It's a minute and a half away from the news at one. Earlier, you heard how winemakers in the state's southwest are calling for a pause on wine bottles being included in the Containers for Change scheme. On the text, Jim says the 10-cent Containers for Change scheme opened on the 1st of October 2020. Since then, 4.5 billion containers haven't been buried. In those 5 years, how many millions of wine bottles haven't been recycled? The government should be sponsoring wine families to recycle wine bottles. We seriously can't just keep burying everything. Thank you for that, Jim. Just repeating the news in case you missed it, Woodside's Northwest Shelf Gas Project has received final approval from the federal government, extending its potential operating life to 2070. The Environment Minister, Murray Watt, has placed 48 additional conditions on the project aimed at protecting nearby ancient Indigenous rock art. These include reducing certain gas emissions by 2030 and also reaching net zero emissions by 2050. Now, we're obviously going to be following this on ABC Radio this afternoon. If you tune into Afternoons with Joe Trilling just after 1:30 today, get the latest on that decision and also hear from the Environment Minister, Murray Watt. Time for the news. It is 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.